Hey there, and welcome to Watering Seeds, a podcast ministry of Covenant Reformed Presbyterian Church in Asheville, North Carolina, where we seek to discuss and apply our most recent sermon in our sermon series through the Gospel of Matthew. Today, we're not doing that. We are talking more of a general review there of where we've been so far in the Gospel of Matthew, and maybe a little bit toward the end about where we're heading. So there is no sermon, technically, to listen to in conjunction with this podcast today. But you should go and maybe catch up on some sermons if you've missed any, which you can find on our website, covenantreform.net/sermons, or by searching for us on sermonaudio.com by searching for Covenant Reformed Asheville, or by searching Sean McCann. Isn't that right, Wilson?
That's very right, yes,
Jim. Oh, whoa! Does that mean Pastor Sean's not on here?
No, he is on here.
He is?
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Whoa! We're all sorts of messed up today. No, we are. We're excited to have three microphones in the room. We're excited to have our pastoral intern, Wilson, who was faithful last summer to join me on this with our series through Esther. So welcome back, Wilson.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Glad to have you here. Glad to involve you on this conversation. You know, normally, Pastor Sean, we would have a sermon outline, some points to walk through. Today, we don't have that. So we're going to look to you now for a little bit of our Matthew review to maybe outline however you want to do this, thematically, chronologically, typologically, Old Testamentologically, however you want to do it.
Okay.
Let us know where we've been in Matthew so far.
Sure. It's only been a year and a half to review in 90 seconds. But something we're going to try to do or need to do a little bit this summer with a lot of the moving parts is do some bonus episodes like this, which gives us a chance to talk about some big picture things in our sermon series and topics around preaching. But it also is going to involve, with Wilson, a lot of moving parts here. So I am glad we get to do this today because we're at a kind of a transition point in Matthew. And so I think it's a chance to catch up where we've been, maybe talk some practical application and where we're going. So there's a particular turning point in Matthew's gospel at the end of chapter 19 as we go into chapter 20. We know that because between 20 and 21, the real big sort of blinking light change is the triumphal entry of Jesus. So that tells us that we've got a week left in the earthly ministry of Jesus. And if you're ready for the end of the book, spoiler alert, we've got a long way to go still. We're only 3/4 of the way through the book. So a long way to go in Matthew, but things change as he's finally arrived in Jerusalem. So where have we been? We have been for a number of chapters heading towards Jerusalem. A couple of hints are dropped in there from Matthew where Jesus is, setting his face towards Jerusalem, on and on. But in this section, as he's going there, he's interacting with his disciples in a unique way. He is receiving lots of questions and feedback from Peter. Peter appears a lot, but only in certain parts of the Gospels. And here, in this section, really maybe 15 and 16 on through chapter 20, we get a lot of questions, we get a lot of misunderstanding, we get a lot of Jesus patiently answering their bad questions in better ways than they're asking. All of it, I think, culminates in blind men who see representing a lot of people that don't understand who Jesus is, and then now finally he's seen. So in all of it, a theme comes out of the first shall be last and the last shall be first, a theme of the humbling of the proud and the mighty and the lifting up of the lowly. And so we see figures like children who come to Jesus. We see blind men coming to Jesus. We see needy people coming to him. And the opposite is we see those who rebuke those needy people are in turn sort of rebuked and pushed away by Jesus. He challenges his disciples who want to be first. He tells parables about deserving and undeserving people. So in all of that, I think we can see a theme that Jesus has come and he loves those who are undeserving. He loves the least of these. He loves the sick and the needy and the poor. You used a word for this earlier, Jim, to capture all those people. What was the word you used?
Undesirables.
You're not calling them undesirable.
Of course not. No. Society didn't desire them or value them. Right.
Very good. So he's interacting with undesirables, I'm putting that in air quotes. And in one
Jesus
way,
Jesus certainly desired them, as right. is kind of the point.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And in one practical application, we see that we should be like Jesus and we should love those types of people around us. I think that's a fine application. I think it's good in scripture that he tells us that. I mean, chapter 18 shows us that we treat the little children well. But I think if that's our only takeaway from these verses, we're missing a bigger point. And the bigger point is that we're the undesirables, to stick with that language. We're the blind, we're the children, we are the lame. And so what do we learn about our relationship with Christ? What do we learn about ourselves? What do we learn about the nature of faith? The fruit of Christian life should be loving the needy around us. But I want to spend this podcast thinking about how we're needy,
mm-hmm.
how we relate to Jesus, and what that looks like, particularly in our Christian lives.
Mm-hmm.
My hope is that one of our big takeaways of the last couple months is to say, I'm undeserving, I'm lowly, I'm last, I'm least of these. Jesus loves me still. He has come to die for me. So the more I embrace who he says that I am, how does that change how I relate to Christ? Mm-hmm. How does that change my experience of the Christian life?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the practical question I want to ask. Before we jump into the questions, did you want to follow up, Jim, on the sort of that framing of the last couple months? Because you preached some of those sermons as well.
That's right. I did. Beyond saying I agree with that thematic element, the only sort of questions that come to my mind are transition questions, which I'm going to save toward the end. Which is going to be, so once we sort of define where we have been and kind of are, really, as we approach the triumphal entry and the massive sort of tectonic shift that presents, in terms of the emphasis, in terms of what Jesus is going to do. Jesus is going to get a lot more, I don't want to say more bold, but maybe more direct. He's not going to be a different person, but he's going to seem a little different, if that's a fair way to put it. The questions I have are about how we should view those last few chapters in light of this. So let's go through this a little bit, if that's all right, with you two gentlemen. And let's dig in. So my first question is for you, Pastor Sean, about the undesirable, the outcast, the undeserving, I think was the word you used. And you mentioned that this section of the gospel really needs to teach us, if I can say it in my words, a little bit about ourselves, right? It sort of inform maybe our view of ourself. Say a little more about, rather than sort of us coming at this from a third party perspective and saying, okay, well then we need to go out and minister to the undesirables, which has an element of truth in it. The more primary emphasis here is seeing ourselves in the grand scheme of things, people in need. Say a little more about how you hope this section of Matthew shapes that sort of view or posture in our minds.
Yeah, I think number one, it should humble us. I think that's the biggest thing for me, biggest takeaway.
Your most recent sermon sort of was the culmination of a lot of this. And that was a huge point in that sermon, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the questions when we read the Bible and the Gospels in particular is who do we resonate with? And sometimes we do with the disciples, and that's fine, especially when they're messing up, and that should be humbling us. But I think all of these, the positive examples that Jesus gives of faith are needy people. And so learning to embrace our place of we're not as strong or as capable or as smart or as faithful as we think we are, but rather he has come for the lowly and he has come for us. So we need to see ourselves through the lens that he sees us, which is really what humility is, sort of stop seeing myself as I see myself, I guess, in my own prideful eyes, and see myself as Christ sees me. And so a humbling effect. I think that produces certain fruit in our life. I think we'll come back to some of those in a minute. I'll give you guys a chance to sort of think about that fruit and what that looks like in our lives.
All right, I'm going to pivot over to the other side of the table here. Come to our pastoral intern, Wilson Goins. Wilson, you have you've sat and you've allowed the word to do its work through the preaching ministry here through the Gospel of Matthew. You've been hearing these themes. You've been hearing these stories. You've been hearing these emphases of Christ. How has the preaching on this theme or on these topics really apply? How has it caused you to view yourself a little differently? How has it caused you to come into a better understanding and appreciation for Christ? How has it impacted you in your Christian life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think oftentimes we forget the tenderness of Christ in our lives and how he cares for us. I think we all, especially as Reformed Christians, you know, there's two sides of the horse to fall off of commonly, which would be sort of antinomianism on one side and legalism on the other side. And I would say that the Reformed most of the time would probably fall towards the legalism side when we're falling towards something. You know, you don't want to fall off either side of that horse. But oftentimes we focus on holiness, and in our sinfulness, we think that we can do it ourselves. We can come to Christ ourselves. We can follow Christ ourselves. We can mortify our sin ourselves. But especially in seeing these two blind men come to Christ and acknowledge that they are in need of something from him that they cannot provide themselves, it reminds us of that love that Christ has for us, that he has done it and he is willing to answer our prayers and to help us to follow him and to see who he is and to grow us in that faith. So that's one of the things that's really been brought out to me, is just the love of Christ for his people and that tenderness that he has towards us.
Mm. That's really good. Pastor Sean, what are you hopeful that our folks in the pews can take with them with these themes and topics into family life, work life, life, right? Not just speaking of you know, prayers and devotions, though all of those things are really good. How does this impact our daily life?
Yeah, so a very concrete example for me is, in humility, is talking less and listening more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think nowhere in here does Jesus tell us to do that. But I think that's a pretty concrete fruit of humility in my life. Humility means maybe I don't have to say something about everything. Maybe what I have to say about things isn't actually that smart. Maybe somebody else has something more important to say. Maybe I'm running people over by running my mouth and not listening to other people. And so I think something as simple as the balance between talking and listening in my own life can reflect how I view myself. Is it through my prideful eyes, or is it through humble eyes? And I would encourage people, myself and others, to think through something just as small and as practical as that. Am I listening more or talking more in my life? Because I think the more we see ourselves as Christ sees us, the more we listen to other people and think, I don't have to pontificate about everything. So that's a very concrete thing for me. I put the question back to you. Concrete ways, and I got others, but you can come back to that.
Yeah.
Very concrete ways that we express this neediness and humility.
Yeah, I mean, I could think of 15 million different ways in which this sort of topic and theme have impacted my view. I've gone through, and I'm thankful for this, a season during this portion of Matthew of really sort of evaluating my priorities and emphases to the point of how am I spending my time? Is my time going more toward myself, what I like to do, if I could say it this way, what puffs me up and makes me look better? Or is my time being dedicated more toward not just others in that way, but is my time being used to point others to Christ? So not so much am I spending my time for others in the sense of going and ministering to undesirables, but being an undesirable, being an undeserving person myself who knows the healing of Christ. Am I spending my time going and telling other people in you know, in my church, in my life, in my family, elsewhere. Hey, this guy healed me and he can heal you too. Does that make sense? So sort of like the blind men that you just preached about, they get healed. You think they might know some other blind guys, you know, you think, or, you know, lepers or whatever. And they go and they tell the good news of their healing to them because, I mean, we're not done with Jesus healing people. We're not done with people, you know, wanting that healing from him. And so the word spreads throughout their camp, right? So am I spending my time spreading that word through the camp towards other people?
Yeah, I think that's real. So I think that's great. I'm going to take another step and get very practical with that. When you walk into a room, who do you go talk to?
Yeah.
I think that's a big indicator of how we view ourselves,
yeah,
the neediness that we have. If we go talk to the important people in the room or the people we're friends with,
yeah,
I don't think that there's nothing inherently sinful about that.
Of course.
But I do believe that the humility produced in here would cause us to go sit with the person that's hard to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
We would go sit with the person who's alone.
Yep.
We would be in a comfortable place and we would reach out to those who are in an uncomfortable place, let's say. Our sympathies would be drawn towards the needy ones among us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how many times in our lives we walk into a room and try to go sidle up to the important person. I mean, I don't know how many rooms our people are going into.
Right.
But I really think we can go with a self-centered view or a selfless view.
Yeah.
I mean, that's even before we talk to people.
That's right. And we talked about this, I'm pretty sure we talked about this in the episode after the Sermon on the Children. And that was, you know, just encouraging our folks to, you know, don't begrudge us on Sundays after the service. We would love to talk to as many people as we possibly can. We want to talk to you. But if the children come to us, we want to interact with them, right? We want to show not only the priorities of Jesus in that, but we also love the children. And we want to honor them and show them that they're welcome. They're desired here. And let's just be honest, children can be a little more sensitive to that. Some adults may be a little more sensitive sometimes. And we can talk about, you know, insecurities. Maybe we should go there. But don't begrudge people who don't come talk to you if your buddy walks in and you want to talk to your friend and he goes and talks to somebody else. You know, follow that example. I definitely want to encourage folks to do
that. And I think it is both an example and it's a growing posture of our heart.
That's right.
Who do we more resonate with?
Right.
You know, it's not just I'm supposed to go talk to that person,
mm-hmm,
but I've been alone.
Yeah.
And the Lord came to me.
That's right.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Jesus ignores the rebuke of other people. So, you know, there's a ton of people who would rebuke us and there's postures in our hearts that obviously can be rebuked. I'm going to ask this question to both of you. So whoever wants to jump in first here, hop on in here, okay? But let's talk about how can we avoid maybe the opposite effect here? How can we avoid the self-loathing issue? So we see some undesirables or undeserving people coming to Jesus. How do we avoid the behavior or the insecurity or the anxiety of, I know I'm undeserving, so I'm not even going to try. Does that question make sense? How do we encourage people to do that? Or if we're feeling that ourselves, how do we respond?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Sean has brought this up several times, but you look at who comes to Jesus in the Gospels and who Jesus goes to. You know, it's the sick who need the doctor, not the healthy. And so I think that would be a way to avoid self-loathing, is that the undesirables are the very people, the first people that Christ has gone to, not the Pharisees who, when praying, say, I thank God I'm not like those filthy sinners, but he goes to the tax collector and the leper and those on the outskirts of society. He goes to the outcast and he lifts them up. He's the deliverer, the one who lifts up the downcast, and acknowledging that we are poor in spirit, that we are downcast. That's how we receive that help. If we don't acknowledge it, then we're not able to receive that help from Christ or to see that we need him. So,
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird dynamic. Who doesn't come to Christ in this section? It's the self-righteous. And so self-loathing is almost born out of a works righteousness worldview and mindset, that the blind and the lame and the sick and the children, they're blissfully free of that, sort of seems like. And so they see Christ and they don't see law. They don't see self-righteousness. And so I do think part of us getting over, I appreciate you bringing up this struggle, but like none of them are seem to be struggling with it in Matthew, at mm-hmm. least. They none of them sort of think I'm too far gone. I'm too impure, whatever. I mean, they see Christ and they go straight to him. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of this is purging the works righteousness out of our system of belief mm-hmm. and our system of faith. I mean, I just think a lot of us are like the rich young ruler. I mean, I just talked about someone the other day and how much they were struggling in their relationship with the Lord because they were struggling. They're not doing well in life. Mm-hmm. Just sort of checking the boxes of life. They're not doing well. And I think part of the discovery this person made was, yeah, I really, when I was doing well in my life, then I was relating well to God because mm-hmm. I had this false assumption that checking off the successful righteousness boxes meant that God loved me. And so now that he's not, he's struggling with his assurance and his mm-hmm. place before the Lord. And part of that's because he had a messed up view of God previously, and it's now bearing bad fruit in his life mm-hmm. now, just like the rich young ruler mm-hmm. had a wrong view of God. So, I mean, these undesirables, it's beautiful, especially the children, like, they're just unaware.
Yeah.
I mean, when children are dirty, like they're sort of unaware of it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I held your beautiful daughter yesterday mm-hmm. in my arms. I love your daughter. And she had a stinky, right? Yeah. And she didn't care. No, I mean, she was blissfully unaware
yeah.
that she was held in the arms of someone who loved her, mm-hmm. even though, man, she stank.
Yeah. Well,
I hope you changed her since then.
We have.
Okay.
In fact,
you're a good dad.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, like, you know, I'm sure all of us have experienced this to some degree, right? The person who has a prayer request, right? Has a need or something like that, but they're like, you know what? No, don't worry about it. It's not that big of a deal. It's not worth other people's time. Sort of almost as if people like believe the crowds that, yeah, I am undeserving, and so I shouldn't speak up, right? And I think that attitude, I wouldn't say is necessarily very prevalent, but it can be maybe persuasive. My issues, what's going on in my life, isn't as big of a deal. And I once heard a pastor say that when we think that and when we say that, you know, Joe Schmo's prayer request is a bigger deal than mine, so I'm not going to bring up mine, right? Because, you know, he's having surgery to save his leg, and I just am having chronic headaches every day, right? Or whatever, make up, you know, smaller prayer requests. He's like, your prayer request, like, it's not your view of the prayer request that's too small. It's your view of who you're praying to that's too small. So there's a level of the humility that we see. Again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but there's a level of the humility that we see of the undesirables and the undeserving who are coming to Jesus, who that their humility is both a proper view that they are undeserving, but also a proper view that Jesus is the one not only who can do something about it, but desires enough to do something mm-hmm. about it, right? So it's a really interesting to me that, like, the blind men come and they ask for mercy. I mean, we talked a lot about that, but I want to bring that up again. The request that they have is very interesting. It's mercy, not, you know, gimme. It's not, even immediately, it's not giving my sight right now. It's not anything else, right? But rather, their view of Jesus is actually what draws them to Jesus, to bring everything to him, not just the big stuff, but all of the things. So that's just sort of striking, that the humility isn't just about me. It's also my view of who Jesus is.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think one practical thing to look at in our own lives is, do I have a spirit of entitlement towards the Lord? And mm-hmm. it expresses itself towards other people. Mm-hmm. But is there, I mean, we're good at seeing it in our children, right? When our children mm-hmm. act like they're entitled. Mm-hmm. But I think we do it as well. I think just was having a conversation with someone the other day and something difficult going on in their life, but they look across the street at somebody else in the same situation and it's going really easy. And it's like, well, that's not fair. Why is it so much easier for them than for me? Mm-hmm. Right. And I think I can sympathize with that, but I think behind that can be a spirit of entitlement, right? That we feel entitled to ease. We feel entitled to blessing. We feel entitled to fairness and justice. And I think the people who feel entitled in this section of Matthew are the crowds that send away the kids and the blind men, the rich young ruler, of course, Peter's, James and John's mom, right? Even Peter himself, that's like, we gave up all this stuff. What are we going to get out of it? And I think that relates to how we see Christ. And if we see ourselves as objects of his pity or objects that deserve something from him. So I would say that in sort of a very practical way, where do you see sort of smoke signals of entitlement, right, in your life? And maybe there's fire there. And how, not how you relate to other people or your boss or your elders, but how you relate to God.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you brought up entitlement, because this brings me to one thing that I want to talk about. We've talked about it before again, but I kind of want to jump back into it, because this is can be a tricky issue. So little background, one way in which this particular issue revealed itself, it was a podcast. We talked a little bit about it before, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, right? Where Mark Driscoll was in Seattle, and it was just a really interesting thing to me that sort of the external or the material wealth, not even just money, but numbers and people and campuses and all that other stuff, seemed, at least in his eyes, to indicate to him that he was doing something right. So much so that there was this great line in an email where somebody sort of just on their way out the door was like, just find somebody and submit to their leadership. Like, just be humble. And his response was, like, I think even John Piper was mentioned, his response was, how can I submit to John Piper when his church is not as big as mine? Right. So let's talk about material, because again, that can bring a sense of entitlement, right? That can bring a sense of, you know, God has blessed me with a bunch of different things. I must be doing something right. That certainly was the case with the rich young ruler. It certainly seemed to be the case with the disciples, not, again, material wealth in terms of like money, but they had position. They were in, you know, they were sort of the chosen 12, right? And look how much we gave up, Jesus. So can you help us think through, maybe one of you wants to talk about the Old Testament, one of you talks about the New Testament and how those relate, or because that's how we've done it in the past. But can we just talk a little bit about how the external, the wealth, the resources, the all of that isn't always a signifier of God's blessing us for the actions that we're doing? Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in because this is the deep end, but I do want Wilson to chime in on this. I think a couple bullet points here. Number one would be the way that God has arranged the world. Generally speaking, if we follow God's law and follow God's wisdom, we will have blessing in this life. That's a general rule. I think those blessings are experienced. The emphasis of the experience of those blessings, this is my view, in the Old Testament is more physical, in the New Testament is more spiritual. Doesn't mean that if we try to arrange our lives now after the resurrection, according to God's wisdom and promises, nothing good's going to happen to us. I actually think the reason the Psalms and Job make so much sense to us is because the right thing isn't happening. I mean, we should think, man, why is that sinful person thriving? And why is that righteous person suffering? Like, because we know that's not how it should be. And so I think there is a recognition. There needs to be a recognition of both how the world's set up and then how in God's timing in a fallen world, it doesn't seem to work the way we want it to work. Now, the problem here is that I think this is sort of in a category of wisdom in Proverbs. Like, you could look at two people that have equally successful homes and businesses, and one could run their business righteously according to God's word, and the other could just be a scumbag, right? But they look exactly the same. And so that takes a whole lot of wisdom for us to judge. We can't just look at people with big homes or big ministries and say, well, clearly they're a wolf. But we also can't look at just people with tiny ministries and say, well, they must be faithful. Like, So I think we're really in the category of wisdom on that question in particular, because of the already not yet experience of our world, that God does bless the righteous, and sometimes we suffer with Christ in our righteousness.
All right. Seminary exam question, Wilson. You just finished exams. All right. We're going to hit you with another one. Walk us through already not yet. Pastor Sean just mentioned that. What is the already not yet in a two sentence definition? Go for it.
Oh man, you really put me
you on the spot here. Let's go.
That was the first sentence.
Do what?
He's a harsh master.
I have here. Three words.
You have one sentence left.
Well, in a sense, you know, the kingdom has come.
Yes.
In Christ, with Christ, the kingdom has been inaugurated.
Mm-hmm.
But there are obviously, as the statement goes, already not yet. There are still things to come. There are still benefits of that coming of the kingdom that have not completely been realized in our lives yet, such as like when we're going through the book of Revelation and seeing all these wonderful things, you know, a city of gold. I mean, we don't dwell there now, but we have the assurance that we will dwell there. We have the blessings of the Spirit. We have all of these things, benefits that have accompanied our justification and our adoption and our sanctification. We're being drawn in with Christ, and we are seeing the world put under the feet of Christ, you know, going with what Pastor Sean was just talking about in terms of wisdom and seeing the wicked prosper. The Psalms even remind us not to be envious of the wicked, because oftentimes we are. We think, you know, I'm living the way that I'm supposed to be. Why am I not prospering? But the psalmist says that they shall soon pass away like grass. And really their end is already set. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
A lot of semicolons. That was a lot more than two sentences.
My apologies.
A lot of semicolons.
Gotta get all the airtime I can here.
That's good.
That's it. You're not preaching in August.
Ooh,
anymore.
Got it. hey, so, before we transition, I mean, we're coming up on our time here. Before we transition into what's next, where we're going, how this shapes and provides the context for what we're about to see in Jesus's ministry in Matthew, are there any other aspects to this that we want to highlight before we talk about how Jesus is going to give us the greatest example of what he's talking about in the end?
I mean, you just gave me one that was really good, back to the Mark Driscoll podcast and his inability to submit. And I think humility means submitting ourselves to God-ordained authorities in our lives,
mm-hmm.
whether that's in the home, whether it's in the civil sphere, or whether that's in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, I think God humbles us by putting us in submission to ecclesiastical church bodies and authorities that we don't always agree with.
Yep.
Currently, because you and I, Jim, are ministers, we are in spiritual submission to the presbytery as a church body. Mm-hmm. Wilson, as a aspiring minister, but he is a member of the local church. So we are under authority. And Jim, put you on the spot. How many times in the last 18 months has Highlands Presbytery done something that you disagree with?
I don't know that we have enough time.
Okay, let's not answer that. We could ask Wilson. How many times have the leaders of your church maybe done something you don't fully agree with?
Yeah.
Hopefully these things are smaller, right?
Right.
They're not, but they're faithful bodies exercising God-ordained authority over us. And I think we really learn humility as we learn to submit ourselves mm-hmm. to God's authority in our lives. And we really only learn humility when mm-hmm. we disagree with that authority.
Yep.
I'm about to get hot here.
I want to go a little deeper, just really quickly, and maybe press in on the distinction between disagreeing and not submitting, right? It's not wrong for me to have a different opinion than the presbytery, just picking up on your example. But maybe a way in which I don't submit to the presbytery would be by being overly litigious, by being overly critical out, in Presbytery, out of Presbytery, by saying, you know what, hey, Pastor Sean, hey there, welcome to Watering Seeds, a podcast ministry of Jim's disagreements on blast with the Presbytery, right? Like, that would be a problem, right? The problem is not that a vote went a different way and I wish it hadn't, right?
Correct.
So the submission is not, are we on the same page? Do we absolutely fully agree? The submission comes down to the court has made its decision and there is no turning back from it. Are you going to continue to buck against it? Are you going to continue to fight against it in unhealthy ways? Or are you going to say, it's okay for us to disagree and I'm going to keep pursuing that relationship and I'm going to keep pursuing the peace, unity, and purity of the church?
Yeah, and I think even more is submission would say, yeah, we disagree, but I'm following the path of my spiritual authority.
Right. That's right.
I'm not going outside that. I'm not just disagreeing with that. I mean, I think in a case, in the heavy cases, a case like church discipline, I'm thinking about a church member and you're trying to work out some sort of resolution with another church member. And for some reason, the session has to get involved and the session helps and it says, we're going to do this, we're not going to do that, or this person's guilty or this person's not guilty. This person's expressing fruits of repentance. This person's not. You need to act towards those other people in submission to your spiritual authorities. And so, I mean, I'm thinking if our presbytery says that Jim has done something so wrong in his teaching that he's now a heretic, it's not going to happen. Right. And I don't really know. I don't really know that I agree with that. But if my presbytery kicks Jim out and says he's a heretic, well, then I'm probably going to need to submit to that.
Right.
That's a weird example. That's the one that pops into my mind.
Yeah, sure. We could definitely go down a path of, I mean, because this is a really important conversation, and maybe we will one day on another bonus episode talk about authority and submission. That seems like a worthy topic because there's a bunch of nuances. Like, for example, what happens when the authority is misused? That is a genuine and an excellent question to be asked. And there are historical cases of the church misusing its authority for sure.
Sure. I mean, PCA is about to celebrate our 50th anniversary of what? Of splitting off from a church authority that we thought was wrong.
Right. Let's book it. Let's pencil it down for another episode because there's a lot to unpack there. But the bottom line is even just approaching every conversation and every disagreement with an attitude and a posture of the humility that we see. Right. And even let me just give this one last example. This just hit me too. The BCO, even in church discipline cases, actually requires us to go and read Galatians. What is it? Chapter 6, right? Galatians 6:1, where Paul gives us a dose of humility, saying, if anyone is caught in sin, is anyone found in sin, if anyone, you know, et cetera, be careful because that temptation may come to you too. Right. Don't think that you're better than that. Don't think that you're above that. Don't think any of that. Because as the scriptures elsewhere testify, Satan is roaming around like a prowling lion, right? Seeking whom he may devour. So we need to be careful of that. And the PCA, I think, has very helpfully put some of those things in. All right. Let's transition really quickly for just a minute or two into how this is going to set up the next section of Matthew. So we've been talking about these themes of entitlement. We've been talking about the themes of humility, talking about the themes of we are undeserving and we need to go to Jesus. And we need to recognize the humility of the blind man is what I want. The humility of the children is what I want. The kingdom of heaven is for these, right? Belongs to these is what Jesus says. So how can I do that? But now Jesus is going to, can I say it this way? Jesus is about to show us the kingdom in a very unique way throughout the rest of the Gospel of Matthew. He's going to, I don't know if pivot's the right word. I don't know if re-emphasize. I don't know if shift emphasis, however you want to say it. How would you describe maybe the next section of Matthew in relation to this one?
Sure. Here's how you do it in two sentences.
Here we go.
Thanks.
Hit the stopwatch. Hit the stopwatch, Wilson.
Sentence one, lamb. Sentence two, lion.
Well, right. Those are not consistent. No verbs in those.
He goes from a lamb, gentle, humble lamb, to a lion. And I think in particular, we see he is no longer focused on the stumbling disciples or the needy crowds. Now his crosshairs are set on the religious leaders. mm-hmm. and he is going to bring that confrontation to a head.
Mm-hmm.
Even the entrance into Jerusalem is humble on a donkey, and then what? He gets to the temple, he starts flipping tables, mm-hmm. right? He goes from lamb to lion.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes back. I mean, after all this confrontation, then we're going to get to the sacrifice of the cross. We're going to go back to the lamb. But I think this is really a section of confrontation, a section of authority, a section where Christ is showing he is king and Lord over all. So that's where we're going.
Yeah. Chapter 23 is one of my, I wouldn't say favorite chapters, but it's a chapter that stands out to me as unique in the ministry of Jesus. Because again, it's not a different Jesus, but Jesus does something different. And that, just for our listeners who are in the car and can't open their Bibles, that's where Jesus gives the woes to the scribes and the Pharisees. That's not really what we've been seeing, because as you say, we've been seeing Jesus focusing in on these crowds and actually sort of humbling the scribe, the Pharisee, the rich young ruler, the entitled, etc. But now he's going to go after them in a unique way. Can we say generally that what Jesus is about to do in his ministry is unique to him and his authority?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's not unique in all of Scripture.
Of course. No,
it's,
I mean,
prefigured,
it's
by
his,
yeah,
not mine.
right. We're not flipping tables.
So
we're not pronouncing woes.
So I've been talking a little bit about the examples that have gone on, right? The example Jesus has given, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're coming into a part where Jesus is the righteous king acting on behalf of his people. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes.
And so what happens, Wilson? This is for you. You ready?
Okay.
Get up to the mic. Here we go. Three sentences, since last time two didn't work.
These limits on me.
How does, in the words of the kids these days,
the kids,
how does this, because you're in youth ministry, yeah. you know their lingo. How does this section hit differently, if
oh,
you will?
No.
If you didn't have this preceding section we just went through? What if Jesus didn't have this theme and this priority of coming to and pouring out mercy upon the undeserving people?
Sure.
If he didn't have that section and he just rolls into Jerusalem day one, and does this, how would that be different?
We would perceive his whole ministry and his whole reason for coming to us and taking on human flesh completely differently, I would say. We would only get half of the picture.
You only get the lion, not the lamb, right?
Yeah, I think that was three sentences.
And there it is. That's great.
No more.
So maybe if you only get the lion without the lamb, that's terrifying. That you only really know how to relate to Jesus through that.
Yeah, you had a really good sermon. I think it was back in chapter 8, where you identified sort of three groups. There's the ones who are following Jesus. There's the ones who are opposing Jesus. And then there's the crowds. And like kind of which way are the crowds going to go, right? And so we hope that the right people are encouraged and the right people are terrified, right? And what Wilson is saying is, if it's only lion, we're just terrifying everybody, right? And so we should read these messages and we should have a sense of, I gotta check myself. I gotta be careful. I'm not guilty of hypocrisy and all this sorts of stuff. But it is that complete picture of the lion who then gives himself as the Lion of Judah and is the lamb, the sacrificial lamb. So for sort of the crowds watching, the Lord only knows kind of which one of those two sides we need, and who needs to be afflicted, who needs to be comforted. And we pray as we preach it that his Spirit applies.
Yeah. So as we end our time together, book blurb, we've been going through this. You brought up antinomian and legalism, Wilson, earlier. You know, as we talk about just half Jesus right there at the end, Pastor Sean, book blurb, book recommendation, Sinclair Ferguson, The Whole Christ. The solution to antinomianism is not legalism. Solution to legalism is not less law, right? The solution to both, the solution to everything that we need is the whole Christ, not half Christ, not our view of Christ, but the whole Christ. So I'm excited to get to this portion. I know that maybe Matthew 24 gives you some heart palpitations, Pastor Sean.
I thought you were preaching that.
I am glad that on the schedule you are. Okay. I'm very excited for that one in particular. But I appreciate this last section. I appreciate what it's done to my heart. Just appreciate you being bold in that. So thank you for those sermons. Wilson, thanks for joining us, brother. Really appreciate your insights, even if they were five instead of two sentences. We'll have you back on soon, I'm sure. Until then, brothers, we will see you next time.
Peace.